Hi, this is Andrew.
And this is Amy. And in this episode, AADL talks to local businessman and former Michigan basketball player George Pommey.
George Pommey was a member of the 1964 and 1965 Michigan Wolverine basketball teams that won back-to-back Big Ten titles and took Michigan to the NCAA tournaments. In the podcast, Pommey recalls his warm relationships with his Wolverine coaches and teammates throughout his playing career and their friendships over the years, as well as playing to capacity crowds at Yost Fieldhouse.
Start by telling us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from, and did you play basketball in high school, and how did you get to Michigan?
Well, I guess I did play basketball, obviously, and I came to Michigan on a basketball scholarship. I'm from Illinois and played in Mount Prospect, Illinois, and it was an interesting situation. My folks moved closer to the city of Chicago because they drove 50 miles each way. And when we were kids, you always talked about the snow being, you know, 6 feet high and you had to walk to school and all those things. But anyway, I went to Grant High School for 2 years, which was about, you know, 50, 60 miles north of the city of Chicago. And then we moved closer to the city and wound up living in Elk Grove Village and then went to Mount Prospect High School. There were actually about three different high schools I could have gone to in the area. And the area grew so much. It was around O'Hare Airport, and the area grew so much that my younger brother, who was 4 years old, younger than I was, went to three different high schools. That's how fast they built high schools, and it used to be all farmland. And as the area grew and the developers came in there and built houses, of course, the population expanded quite a bit. And I was in the first graduating class from Mount Prospect, and we just had our 50th high school reunion. So I went to two different high school reunions this past summer, and it was, you know, kind of nostalgic. The basketball coach that is there now is a history teacher, and he was very much interested in the history of the school. And since we were the first basketball team, he invited us all back during the basketball season last year. And our high school coach was still there, and so we got to see there was only 12 players on the team, two of which were juniors, and a couple of them, unfortunately, have passed away. And they had a potluck dinner beforehand, so we got there, and it was a big title game between them and the other team that was tied for first place. And so we got there and had that, and then he had basketballs for us to sign, and we didn't know it at the time, that he was going to give them to us. But as they introduced each of us, they gave us the basketball that we had all signed as team members and gave us letter sweaters. We had letter sweaters that he gave us. Everybody was kidding because they said, well, I still got my sweater, but nobody fit in them anymore. I think I probably came the closest to still being able to wear mine, but looked like a stuffed sausage. So that was, again, kind of a fun type thing. Then they had us back for football, too, because, again, being the first graduating class, and I don't know why, but our teams were very, very successful as juniors and seniors. We lost four basketball games those 2 years by a total of 6 points, and two of the games were in overtime. And I had forgotten all about it, but the last game of the year, and we were ranked like second in the state, we got upset in the quarterfinals, and it was a sudden-death overtime. For 1 year, the state of Illinois decided they were going to have sudden death overtime. And the first overtime, nobody scored. And the whole game, a couple of our players were in foul trouble. So we didn't have, you know, everybody that – otherwise we should have won pretty easily, but that's the way sports are. And a kid got fouled and never hadn't even played in the game before. He had averaged 2 points a year. He hit both foul shots and the game was over. And our coaches still to this day said the officials were so bad, obviously. When aren't they bad when you lose? So that's kind of my background of things. And I got recruited to go to, you know, several Big Ten schools and everything. And
why did you pick Michigan?
Well, Dave Strack was the coach here at the time. And my folks really thought that he was a very outstanding person. And they had Jim Scala and Tom Jorgensen were the other two assistants at that time. And they really thought that they were outstanding people. And Michigan at that time wasn't real good in basketball. So from a selfish standpoint, you say, well, maybe I'll have a chance to play at Michigan with, you know, them not getting as many good players. But that was kind of the start of their recruiting in Illinois. They recruited pretty heavily because both Jim Scal and Tom Jorgensen had contacts with alumni there. And so they did a lot of recruiting in that area. And then after Tom Cole was actually a couple of years ahead of us, was from Springfield, Illinois, and met him when we came up here on our recruiting trip. And then after that, we had, of course, Cassie Russell and John Thompson, John Clausen. There were a bunch of Illinois players that they were able to convince to come here to school. And Cassie's year was really, I think, after ours, because Billy Bunton was in our class and Larry Tregoning and I were the three players that played on the, you know, on the team regularly. And then after that, of course, Cassie and Oliver Darden and, you know, Jim Myers and John Clausen, John Thompson. There was just a slew of good players that came here, which obviously is why that we were so successful for three consecutive years.
Yeah, last night at the Beeline show, they brought your team up to 64-65. Year is one of the highlight of Michigan basketball.
Well, as you know, with them tying for the championship this year, it was been a long time since they did that. It was 25, 26 years ago. And at the time that we played, if you didn't win the championship, you didn't get to compete in the NCAA. It wasn't that there were 64 teams. If you didn't win your league championship, you were finished. The NIT was a possibility. So my junior and senior year, we won the championship. And then Cassie's senior year, who was a year behind me, they won three consecutive championships. And I think they've only won six or seven since then. And here we are, what, since 65, you add that up. Going on 50 years pretty soon.
Do you remember the recruiting process, what it was like? How did it work back then?
Well, they basically, you would go for a weekend, and normally the current players would, you know, take you a variety of places and to dinner, and you'd meet with the coaches, and then usually you would go on your own rather than with your parents. And then if they were serious about wanting you to come there, and of course then they would get involved, come to your house, meet your parents so that they, you know, could try to get a good idea of what the coaches were like. And it was a good experience for me to come here. We had a football player that was also being recruited by Michigan that wound up going to Army to play for Paul Dietzel and was also a good basketball player. And the alumni recruiting at that time, they used to use the alumni to help recruit. Now they don't like that because there's been so many illegalities of people doing the wrong thing and offering extra benefits and things that they won't even tell you who they're recruiting most times. So it's until they sign somebody, you don't hear a lot about, you know, the recruits that they have. And there was a man that was a football player here at Michigan by the name of Chuck Ortman. Was an All-American football player here that did a lot of recruiting because he knew Jim Scala. They were in the same class in the same era here at Michigan. And so they utilized the alumni there to scout and go see players. And then when it came time for us to visit, since Michigan was so close, we didn't fly to Detroit. Chuck Ortman actually picked Bill and I up and drove us up here to Ann Arbor. And that just doesn't happen anymore. But it has something to say about the recruiting budgets and what they spent and things at that time. And we had just a phenomenal weekend. If you could ever fall in love with another man, I think Chuck Ortman would be the person I was. He was very, very personable. In fact, I still have contact with him. He lives down in Savannah, and our family has always gone to Hilton Head periodically. And so we usually are in contact with him and try to see he and his wife. And, of course, he's the same age as Dave Strack. He's, you know, in his late 80s now. And so it's a friendship.
Dad's still alive?
Oh, yeah, Dave is. His wife died. Dave's had some memory issues, but I speak to him periodically, and it's always a, you know, guess as to what's going to happen. Some days are better than others. But, yeah, and unfortunately now he, you know, he's in Arizona still, and he won't be coming back. Our team has always had reunions. Nobody knows about them. Just, they always say how hockey is so involved in the reunions and things, but our basketball team started out meeting every 5 years. And I think it's because we had a bunch of close people at that time, but the winning obviously helps. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us were fraternity brothers together. There were seven of us that were Lambda Chi Alphas here in town on the basketball team. And we've obviously kept close contact with each other. But then as we got older, we started meeting every 2 years. And since I'm in town, I kind of am the one that gets the pleasure of putting all that together and making sure everybody comes back. And so, it, you know, they still, you know, we don't get everybody back every year, but unless there's some, you know, circumstances, everybody tries to come back. And it's unfortunate that Dave, you know, made one 4 years ago, and he just, it's impossible for him to come back now, unfortunately. So
you recruited. How was it different about coming here? So you were able to live at a frat house. You didn't have to live in an athletic dorm?
Well, they actually didn't have any athletic dorms. And Michigan's one of the few places that don't. I mean, a lot of the southern schools are notorious for having athletic dorms. And I think in a way it's probably better that you don't. You become much more rounded. But again, so then we go back and get off the tangent here with Chuck. We wound up stopping at a dairy in Indiana, and they had ice cream bowls that were bigger than cereal bowls, you know, and had 10 scoops of ice cream in there. When you're a kid, you know, you could do that. And then we stopped at Wynn Schuler's in Marshall on the way up. And, of course, Wynn wasn't there at the time, but Wynn knew everybody by first name. I mean, his mind was exceptional. He'd meet you, and then he'd know you forever. And then we came up here and wound up, you know, going into the varsity swimming pool and glowing up. I might have been a swimmer if I'd have had swimming as a high school sport, because I grew up on a lake before we moved closer to the city. And so we wound up going up on a platform, and it's about 30 feet up in the air. Well, anyway, you know, a lot of times they'll go up there and you can jump off. And it's always been said that Gus Steiger used to have people go up there, and then just about they're ready to jump, he'd shut the lights off. So you'd be in the dark going down there. He wasn't there that day, luckily. So it was just a great weekend. I mean, we liked the kids that we met here and everything. And as I say, I think Bill would have probably come here if he hadn't, you know, gone into the service and done that. So
sounds like you remember all the games really well.
Yeah. I don't have a great memory for all those things. In fact, I don't know if you were watching, but I wound up going to the Nebraska game this year. I flew with some friends to see the game because it was the first time that they were going to play as Big Ten play. And I said, well, we might as well go there. Well, I had forgotten all about it, but one of the games we lost as a senior was to Nebraska. And that was the last time we played them. And so it was a big deal for them. And I had somebody from Nebraska call me, and I didn't remember. He said, well, do you remember who the guy was that shot the final shot? And I'm thinking, why in the world would I remember that? He said, you remember how many points you scored? So when I got there, they evidently knew I was coming or something. Somebody must have mentioned that. So the TV crew had picked us up in the crowd because we sat right behind the team bench a couple of times, and they were talking about the fact that the last time we were here, you know, George Pommy was on the team, and they named me the sixth man for the game because I was there the last time they played. And we got beat at the buzzer by 1 point. Guy drove across the lane. Somebody was guarding me, threw the ball up over his shoulder, and it went in. And, of course, we only lost 4 games that year and were ranked number one at the time. So, you know, we dropped out of being number one, losing to Nebraska, you know, that particular year.
Do you remember the game with Purdue?
Indiana was probably the most outstanding game we had at the time. The Purdue game I don't, but there were good teams in the Big Ten. We had 5 of the top 20 teams in the country were in the Big Ten our senior year. So just like they are now, they've got 5 teams that are in the, you know, in the top 15. So there was good quality talent. And again, as I say, if you didn't win the league, you're out of luck. And the Van Arsdale twins were at Indiana at that time, a guy by the name of John McLaughlin, who all played in the pros. And we really only had Cassie, you know, that really had a career in the pros. Oliver played, you know, for a while, but played at Indianapolis in the ABA rather than the NBA when that league was still in existence. And we were down couple different times in that game, and of course, you know, they were yelling overrated, you know, and because of the fact we were number one, I mean, we were down like 4 points with 20 seconds to go in regulation. We tied the game up, went into overtime, we're down again, you know, 4 points with less than a minute to go, and wound up tying it again and winning in double overtime. And so that, in a way, at that time, Indiana was had a field house just like Yost. They weren't big arenas like they are now. And so that was kind of a, you know, a big win for us. And in fact, Bobby Cantrell, who was a captain the year before, you know, we were here, came down to the game and wound up almost getting in a fist fight with the coach in the locker room afterward, because of course they were upset that they got beat. And you both went down the same corridor to get to your lockers, and so there was a little confrontation because he came here as Mr. Basketball from Indiana, and he was only 5'10". And Indiana was never really interested in him too much, and so he wound up coming to Michigan. So there was always a friction, I think, with him and the fact that, you know, they didn't recruit him, and now, of course, he was on teams that beat them on a regular basis. So
now, did you ever play in Chrysler?
No.
Finish your career in the Yost Fieldhouse.
Right, which was an advantage. It was a great floor, other than a lot of activities going on in there. And one of the pictures I brought has a picture of the canvas that was around the court. There used to be in their track was running. They'd be shooting guns off to have people run their sprints. The baseball team had a net at one end of the floor. You know, in the spring, they'd be hitting baseballs in the batting net. They'd open up the overhead garage door that was at the south end of the place when the football team would come in, because all the locker rooms were in – there was no other place. There were no other locker rooms or anything. It's not like it is today where everybody has their own. And so when we were freshmen – freshmen weren't eligible. And so periodically we would come over and scrimmage the varsity. And as our team got better, we would compete with them. And the football team would come in sometimes and stand around the floor watching practice, and they'd heckle them because here are these freshmen, they are giving them a battle. And so that was when they decided to put a canvas tarp around the practice facility. So when they came in, they didn't bother us. And they couldn't see what was going on. So
now for the 63-64... when you went to the NCAA, were you a sophomore or a junior?
I was a junior.
You were a junior.
Right.
How long of a gap was there between winning the Big Ten championship and then heading for the games in the Big Dance?
It was within 2 weeks, I'm sure, yeah, because all the leagues were over relatively at the same time, so then you know who the competition was going to be at that time.
And where did you travel to play?
Well, I know we played in Kansas City. One of them.
Bus, plane?
Oh, we flew a lot, and we flew on DC-3s, which are the ones that sit on their tail, and they're one of the safest planes they ever made. I mean, they could land anywhere if you had issues or anything, but the weather, had a big deal to do with what you do. You have to be, de-iced and all those things, and Cassie did not like to fly at all, and especially in those little planes. And so a lot of times he'd get in there and he'd just cover his head up with a blanket and you wouldn't see him until we got wherever we were going. So and we'd bus to, to Ohio State and the Michigan State, but we did fly, and charter as much as we could. And obviously some places you couldn't because they were so far and you'd fly commercial. So, but they did have quite a following as the team got better. They started playing games on Channel 50 and had a lot of things that as the team was successful, people got more and more behind the team. And so there were some cases when we'd go, like when the national tournament was on, they would charter a bigger plane and some of the alumni would, buy tickets to go on the plane to travel with the team at that time.
Now, did all the teams get housed together or were you all put up at separate hotels?
No, when I was a freshman, we lived in South Quad.
No, I mean, when you traveled to the NCAA, would you have met guys from other teams in the hallways of the
hotel?
Normally,
they would have – each team would have their own hotel so that you didn't run into each other or have those issues, to deal with. But sometimes if it was a big enough hotel, you might have more than one team that would be there.
Do you remember the experience of the NCAA?
No, you're so busy when you're there. You go to practice and they have each of the teams, like with the Final Four, you go there and each of the teams has a designated time when the press is there to watch them and do films and interviews with the players and – so you do your practice and then you're off and then they keep you pretty busy. I mean, you've got, pregame meals, you've got, time set up even now. I mean, they go there and, the trainer gets there early and he's got everything's on clockwork. You can eat at 10 o'clock, you have film at 11. I mean, you're busy. You get some time at night where you could do that, but you didn't have time to go out and that. Unless we were playing a night game and we got there the day before, we'd have some time to to go out. And I used to take pictures a lot. Of the kids used to tease me because I'd always have my camera. And we would stay when we went to Wisconsin, we'd stay right on the lake. There was a really nice hotel there that we stayed at, and it was on the lake. And I've got pictures of a bunch of us walked out on the ice. I mean, the ice was a couple of feet thick at that time, standing there with the hotel in the background and everything. So it's nice because I, have all those slides that I go through still periodically to show the kids and grandkids. And it's a nice memory to have. So now everything's digital, and I should put all that stuff on a CD, I guess, to be easier to watch. But I still have my carousels full of trays and slides.
Now, one thing I had forgotten, because I was a big fan back then, was that you played a consolation game.
Yeah.
And so you lost to Duke, and they made you stick around and play another game. Talk about that.
Well, it was – And they obviously have done away with it. Why do you, once the tournament's over, why do you want to have a, you know, then you can lose two games to end up the season. And fortunately, we wound up, one of those years, we played against Princeton. Bill Bradley was at Princeton, and we played them twice. Played him in New York, and we should have never beat him, but he committed a silly foul right towards the end of the game. And then again, it's one of those games we were down, but the rest of the play, they didn't even get the ball over half court four times in a row, and we wound up, winning the game. But if he'd have stayed in the game, then, we would have never had a chance to beat him. And then so we played him again in the consolation, and, it wasn't a close game at that time, but he was a good, good player.
Now, from one of the news articles that we've seen, you were injured in the Ohio.
I don't remember that. I know I had to have my wrist taped, quite a bit during my senior year. I sprained it. Somebody probably blocked a shot and pushed my wrist back. So I did have to have my wrist taped a lot. But it wasn't anything serious. And I look to this day, and you get so many athletes had so many surgeries. And I never, all the things I played, baseball, football, softball, all during high school. In fact, my high school coaches thought I would probably play football here, which I never did. But an interesting sideline to that is I came home and I was living in the fraternity, and my roommate said, somebody from the Dallas Cowboys called you. And I said, yeah, I got better things to do. Don't be kidding me. Well, if you remember, Pete Gent was a basketball player at Michigan State and actually wound up playing for the Dallas Cowboys. And so in that era in the 60s, they believed that if you had athletic skills that – especially for a defensive back or whatever, they could teach you the rest of the things they wanted. And so I did. He finally did call me, and it was true, but I had no interest in, doing that. But I did get drafted by the St. Louis Hawks after I got out of college, and I did go to, camp with them, and they wanted me to come back. But at that time, one of the issues was during the Vietnam era is that, you were subject to be drafted unless you were in school. You could get a deferment for being in school. So my plan was that I would go back and did go to grad school. I admired all my coaches that I played for, especially in high school. So my ambition at that time was I was going to probably go and coach basketball somewhere and teach high school, and I didn't want to be in the gym all day. And so I was going to get my degree in guidance and counseling in graduate school so that I could, do something other than be in the gym all day and the rest of the night too. And that, is what I did do. After my first year of grad school, the freshman coach, Tom Jorgensen, left, and I was here, and I was helping him. And so all of a sudden, here I am, 1 year out of college, and I'm the freshman basketball coach at the University of Michigan. And right before the season started, the assistant coach, Jim Scala, left to go into private industry. So all of a sudden, instead of me being the third on the totem pole and wet behind the ears and things, all of a sudden the season's about to start, and it's Dave Strack and George Pommy. They have two coaches, three. And that's when Dick Honig, who is to this day, one of my best friends, was assistant baseball coach and was an all-around athlete. And so they didn't want to go out on the street looking for somebody because, the season was getting ready to start. So Dick came and helped us in basketball. And so it was the three of us then. And then the next year, I was too young to be an assistant really at that point in time and was just learning the business. That is when Dave Strack hired John Orr. Mm-hmm. And then after John was there, which was my second year, Dave retired from coaching and became the associate athletic director. When Don Cannon was announced as the athletic director, he wanted Dave to help him with all the clerical things. And so then John was there, and I was on the staff and stayed. And at that time, it was prevalent, as it is today, to have, a black assistant. So Fred Snowden out of Detroit came up and was there. So I coached for two more years. At the end of my fourth year, I went into the insurance business with State Farm in town, and that's been a long, long career now. So
you were going to graduate school the whole time you were doing the assistant coaching?
I did, and of course, I couldn't go full-time anymore, so I actually wound up taking classes on Saturday. And so it didn't get done in 2 years. And at that time, you had an option of either doing 30 hours of classwork or 24 hours in a thesis. And I wasn't really big on writing a thesis and spending all that time and then having someone say, no, it's no good. So the 30 hours was a better choice for me. And as I say, I went, and it wasn't easy because of the fact we had games, we were on the road. my second year into business, I saw like 140 basketball games. That's not only our own, but college and scouting high school kids. And so you're on the road all the time. Yeah, it was.
Well, let's back up a little. Before I ask this question, did you and the other team members read the papers? Did you read Dineff and the other reporters that wrote about you in the Ann Arbor News?
Sure. And the Daily at that time was a big thing, and you got more from that because it was local. But as I said, and I should have brought them so that you could have looked at them. I pulled some pictures out of them. But my mom made huge scrapbooks for me and got all the clippings. And, of course, I would send them to her. She'd go, and even some of the Chicago papers, because it was Big Ten, would have articles in there. And so she cut them out. And I told Jackie before I came in, I mean, the Scotch tape is kind of bleeding through the articles now, and the pages are kind of loose and everything, because it's, you know, you're going back a long time now as to when she did those for me. But it was interesting, too. She also did that for me in high school. And when you go away as a freshman, you're on your own for the first time, you know, you can get discouraged about a lot of things. And when things would get bad, I'd pull out my high school scrapbooks and I'd look at things and make yourself feel better about what was going on there. And it was interesting because we went back for that basketball reunion. There was another, this Bill Zedell, who came here to be recruited. His mom had put together a scrapbook for him as well. Well, he, instead of bringing the loose leaf scrapbooks, he had them mimeographed and brought copies for everybody, had them, you know, bound with a wire and things. And it was interesting because you'd look at the articles and his mom highlighted everything about him. And in mine, even then they had highlighters. My mom highlighted everything about me. So I had my scrapbooks. He had his printed up for everybody. And it was interesting to see which articles got put in whose scrapbook.
Well, we were reading through the articles and, of course, UCLA and them, they had the Whiz Kids. You were nicknamed the Bloody Nose Kids. Do you know why?
Well, it's because we were all pretty big. I was looking at the scrapbooks against the runt of the litter, if you will, and I was, you know, I was 6'4", 200 pounds, and I was the smallest of the starters. And we weren't big in those days. I mean, Bill Bunton was 6'8", but he probably weighed 280 pounds. And so we were very noted for our defense, and, you know, you didn't want to drive down the lane because you might come out with a bloody nose. That was how the Bloody Nose Lane title got attached to our team, and the fact that, you know, our defense was outstanding at that
time. Then we completely misread it. We thought it meant you guys kept getting injured.
No. No. It's the other way around, probably.
Now, in 65, there was a really fabulous year. There was a second straight Big Ten championship. Strzok was named top coach, and U of M was ranked number one in the AP poll. And you and Larry were named the second team Big Ten All-Academic. How hard was it for the two of you to manage to do well academically and participate fully?
Well, I found that the busier I was, I didn't waste time. You know, when it was in the off season, you go back, somebody said, you want to play bridge, you want to do this. Oh, yeah, you know, you do that. Well, you knew that you didn't have the time because, I mean, I didn't get home to the fraternity normally until 6:30. And I, again, enjoyed that because of the fact that you had meal plan at that time, too. A lot of the fraternities now, that they're not as popular, they don't even have meals together. And that was when all the fellowship occurred, is you'd have dinner together. And we used to dress, you know, in a shirt and tie. Well, during the season, I couldn't do that. But we had a cook. And she would always make up a plate of food and stick it in the oven. And sometimes the mashed potato, you know, you have to beat them a little bit to get them. But at least I was eating a square meal instead of going eating McDonald's or whatever. And so, you know, that for me was a good situation to be there. And as I say, if I had time to waste, you usually find time to waste it. And I think in life now with your jobs, it's the same way. When you got plenty of time, you find things that aren't necessarily fruitful, whereas if you're on a tight schedule, it's amazing how much you can get done, and then you don't, somebody calls and says, you want to do this, say, no, I can't. So it wasn't as hard. It wasn't easy, but it wasn't as hard as you would think because you just had to be disciplined.
Now, you're from Illinois. Why did you make Ann Arbor home? Was that because you started graduate school and you started coaching and you just sort of...
Yeah, I was here. And as I say, I don't know where I would have wound up if I hadn't gotten the job on the basketball staff. So that's kind of what evolved in that. And then, of course, the next step would have been to try to go somewhere. And I did apply for, you know, a job somewhere else. And It's a tough business. When you analyze things, you say, here I am, my whole reputation and livelihood and everything else is dependent on 17, 18, 19-year-old kids and the decisions they make, which was kind of hard. And I had a tough couple of years with kids, the freshman kids that I coached. And I had someone, that was a local manager for State Farm came in my office one day and said, if you know anybody that's interested in the insurance business. And I was kind of having a rough year anyway. I said, I might be interested myself. Well, it took another year for me to go through that process with him to really decide that, that Ann Arbor was a great place to live and to raise a family. And the potential income-wise compared to what I was making from basketball, was a lot more. And it wasn't just the money, but it just made sense for me at the time. And so this has been home, ever since we played here. And we've got a lot of great memories. The kids, grew up here. And also, all three of my kids were pretty decent athletes. My son, the youngest one, wound up going to Gable Richard. All the kids went to Gable Richard, but wound up winning a Class C championship at Gable Richard. And the best athlete was probably my daughter. She was all state in three different sports.
Really?
She played volleyball, softball, and basketball. She probably should have tried to walk on as basketball, but she came on a partial baseball scholarship here to play for Carroll and didn't like it. It was no longer fun. It was a business, and she got hurt, unfortunately. Her first spring year, she slid into third base and hurt her ankle, and so she was on crutches, had to go down there every day. She wanted to look at a sorority, and they pretty much said the team's a sorority. And so I met her one day, and we had a lot of tears about what was going on. And philosophically, I always said, draw a line down here. I want you to put what's good here and what's bad over here. And it was an emotional thing, but I said, you don't have to play to make us happy. You have to be happy and enjoy what you're doing. And a lot of kids, go through that period where it's fun, which it was for me, but it wasn't any longer for her. So she quit and was a sorority girl.
So you have kept up with the team. Tell us more about the reunions.
It was interesting when they first started. It was kind of like a fashion show when everybody would come and the gals would be all dressed up. And then as time goes by, typically all of a sudden, the first wife was gone and everybody would look forward to seeing who the new girlfriend was. The typical group. I mean, if you have friends, it's a way of life, unfortunately. And unfortunately, it's too high a percentage of people that don't make it anymore. And it was interesting because after a couple of get-togethers, John Thompson got up and said he wanted to, and we would talk and things like that. He says, I want to say something. So he got up and he went around the room and talked about everything he remembered about each one of the players individually. And so it's been a tradition now that everybody, would get up and say what they remembered and, the fond things they had. And we've never had any negative things that have come out of that group. But the thing I enjoyed the most is one night, and the women, of course, come to everything, and the functions and everything, and Ruth Ann Strack, after everybody was done, she gets up, she says, I want to say something. So then the women got involved in adding their two cents, and a lot of us dated, our wives at the time when we were in college. So they, too, were part of the group. They knew everybody because, we partied together. We did a lot of things together besides basketball. And I think that's, unfortunately, now with the way athletics has progressed, I'm not sure that there's the individual personal bonds that we had. As I mentioned, a lot of us were in the same fraternity. We'd go out afterward. We used to get chits to go to the union afterward, and we'd go together. We didn't each go our separate way. And I really have the sense that I don't think that happens anymore, which I think is a shame. I mean, we used to go to the football games together. The M Club was very strong. We'd go to support the wrestling team, and I mean, we'd go wear our leather jackets. And, we knew the football players, the swimmers, the divers, the wrestlers. We knew all those people. We were all pretty good friends. And I seriously doubt that that's the case now. I think they're all so busy in their own way that I don't think that there's that camaraderie, if you will, not only in the sport, but with the other teams and things that
you think is because Michigan athletics is so big.
I think
that you didn't have that family feel to it.
I don't know that it was. It's much more of a business now, I think, than it was then. A lot more pressure on everybody because of the money that's involved. I mean, I left at the time when we were here, my wife taught high school in Garden City. She made more money the first year she taught in high school than I did the second year as an assistant coach at Michigan. And thankfully, the assistants now make enough money to survive. I mean, in the off season, we didn't work 24 hours a day, you know, 12 months a year. I mean, I painted houses in the summer. I, you know, delivered grain. I did a lot of things just to make ends meet, you know, so that we could have some of the things that we wanted to be able to raise a family. And thankfully, that's not the case anymore. You know, Fritz Kreisler thought it was a privilege to work here, which it was, but you still, the reality was you needed to, you know, to have enough to raise families. There were other coaches that said, gee, you know, how'd you get this job and everything when they found out what I made? I mean, they were making 2-3 times as much coaching high school ball. How could they afford to raise a family and make the transition to come here? So I started at the right time when I didn't have all those obligations and things. And, you know, it took us, you know, driving used cars and, you know, doing all those things and then eventually save enough money to, you know, with my wife teaching, we saved her money and had enough money to buy our first house. Otherwise, you know, that would have never happened. And we started our family, you know, fairly quickly within a couple of years of getting married. And so the rest of that's all history.
So what do you think of the Michigan team today?
Well, they're a tough team. I think they're a team of overachievers. I mean, they've got some great players, but who would have thought that a Zach Novak or a, you know, a Douglas would be as outstanding as they are? And it's a tribute to John Beilein, really, for the job he's done with bringing these kids along. And my hat's off to him. He's done a phenomenal job, and the kids have all gotten better. And a lot of times, when you're recruiting people, you don't know where they are in their development scale. They may be the best they've ever, you know, they might be 16 years old and never get any better. And I think a great deal of that has been his coaching, the way he's brought those kids along. When you compare the teams with Ohio State and Michigan State, I mean, would you, if you were on one of those teams, substitute one of your players for a Zach Novak? Maybe because of the way he plays so hard all the time. But if you looked at a talent level, I mean, he's a couple of steps, in my estimation, below those other players. But John gets 100% plus out of him every game, and that's a tribute to Zach in the way he's been taught, you know, with his high school background. And now he absorbs everything that John gives them and tries to get them to perform. And again, it's just, you know, even with Hardaway, who's got talent there, it's a constant thing. He's only a sophomore, you know, and John keeps pointing that out, that he'll continue to get better because of the coaching that they get. And the assistants are the same way. They just, you know, are constantly giving more and more things to those kids to be able to improve. And it's, as I say, since they are overachievers, who knows? It depends on the matchups, like Purdue. You know, Matt Painter is a great coach, and they really did an outstanding job defensively. And when you look at Michigan, you know, why, and you say, well, we backed into the championship, but they beat Michigan State, they beat Ohio State, they lost to them twice, but they beat them twice. So, again, you know, it isn't whether you win early or lose late, it's did you win the championship? And obviously they, you know, are enjoying the fact that they wound up through a set of circumstances doing that. So
you're going to go down to Indianapolis?
I had not planned on that. We've had some time off already, and we're going down to with our two of our kids down to Hilton Head. We do that usually in the spring at Easter time. And so we've got that scheduled already, and there's only so much time that I can, you know.
But I'm sure you're going to follow.
Oh, yeah. I'll be watching. I'll be watching.
Do you like that they've gone to the system of you end the season and then you do a whole other playoff for the Big Ten?
It's all money. You know, they do it everywhere else, so they, you know, pretty much were forced into it, and the Big Ten was one of the last teams to do that. And it causes some complications, in my view, when you do that. I mean, here you can have teams that are, you know, going to be in the tournament anyway, and they go into the playoff, the Big Ten tournament or whatever other conferences they have, and some team will come up and that hasn't had a good record. They could even have a losing record, and they wind up getting hot, win 3 games. Now, all of a sudden, you got a team that's not as capable as a lot of teams that should be in the tournament that are partaking in that. Really wouldn't bother me if they opened it up and had everybody eligible. Just have one more series of games. I mean, that would cut it down, right? I mean, they start with 64. They could let everybody in, have one more game, and then can't say everybody's getting cheated out of having the opportunity to play. But, you know, I'm sure there's some logistics to that. And then you got the NIT, of course, too, would be left out in the lurch if they did that. So
now the NIT was a lot bigger when you were playing. That we kind of look at it askance now, but yeah. Back then the NIT was a big.
because there weren't 64 teams in the national tournament, so sometimes the teams in the NIT might have been as good or better than, and that's still the case. I think some of the teams that got left out right at the end on a selection process are involved in that, and it helped Michigan when they were, you know, struggling along to be able to go there and win that. I mean, that's certainly a, you know, it's a nice accomplishment. Plus, the extra games are a big deal. It's just like when the team went to Europe to have that extra couple of weeks of practice, you know, with those young kids is a definite advantage. It isn't always, you know, that you're going to the nicest places and it's like a vacation, but, you know, they do get to play a good quality competition and things. And our team went, was at the end of my senior year, we went to Europe for actually a month. We were supposed to represent the country in the Budapest Games, and right at the last minute they decided not to have us go as a team, and so Bill Bunton from our team went and played with them. But again, we didn't go to the garden spots of the world. We went to Egypt, Turkey, Greece, and Algeria. And so, you know, some of the housing and the food and everything else was pretty tough for a bunch of young kids. But again, it was an experience that, you know, for 4 weeks we were together and, you know, lived like a family and went through a lot of interesting experiences, but got to see again, you know, some very, very interesting things. Got to see two wonders of the world that I would have probably never, you know, done. And now with the climate in some of those countries, I don't think that you'd feel comfortable.
Do you think it was the first trip to Europe for most of the kids that you went with? Wouldn't it have been?
I'm sure it was. Yeah.
And what kind of teams were you playing against?
Well, from little kids to, you know, the national championship team. We went, when we were in Egypt, they took us, you know, and they actually, we went to one city and played in a indoor stadium. The stadium hadn't been used for 6 years since the NBA team came over and played there. So they had to paint it and, you know, get it all, you know, ready to go. But there were some times we were there and we actually took a referee with us. They told him he was going to be running clinics and doing things like that. Well, he's involved in a full game. I mean, the guy was 60-some years old at the time. He probably hadn't refereed on the floor for years, and here he is, one of the two referees. And we played in the Olympic Stadium in Athens, and we actually came down, and you know, everybody was kidding. He said, they're about to let the lions loose. I mean, it was like a tunnel coming down into the stadium, and they had two strands of lights and the baskets there. And they went up to dunk or something and then came and split the backboard. So they had to delay the game to be able to do that. And the people there historically, when you looked at the stadium, it was big blocks of granite that they sat on outside. And they had a unique way of clapping. It would go. And that was their chant when they would go there. And we actually tied. And they at the end of the regulation thing, they said, we're done. Your referee's cheating us. They didn't want to play anymore. And if it was anything, it was the opposite. That poor guy, you know, felt so sorry for him. And he was so upset about the fact that they thought that he wasn't doing a good job that we went to a dinner after the game. He wouldn't go. And that was at the time they were having riots in the streets in Athens. And so back home, people were reading, you know, rioting in the streets in Athens. We actually, in the hotel we were staying at, they shot tear gas off in the lower level. While we were gone, the official that stayed behind said, well, you're glad you weren't here. He said they were rioting in the street, he said, and actually I had to close the balcony windows because of the fact that the tear gas was coming up into my room. So, you know, thankfully we didn't run into any of that, but it was interesting. So the Egyptians, it was a business for them. You know, they sold tickets and they paraded us every place they possibly could. But then we went, you know, like to Greece, and we had kids that were, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. We would show them different things to do, and then they wanted us to play them at the end of the night. They wanted us to play against them. So we kind of stood around like you would with kids here. You'd give them the ball and, you know, and not try to make a thing because it was ridiculous what they were doing. But that was one of the competitions there.
Now, I remember reading that a few of the guys were considered for the Olympic team. Did any of the guys play for the Olympic team? I can't remember. Did Cassie or anyone?
I don't know that Cassie. I don't know what the circumstances were. He obviously could have done that, but I don't know that he, because it's every 4 years, so he might have been in between there. So he might have gone into pros. And at that time, they didn't let the pros play. So I'm sure the circumstances were that the four-year sequence didn't come when he was ready to do that. So,
could we see what you brought us?
Sure. These are just I pull these out of the scrapbook, and they're 44 is me. So I'm obviously, since my mom made these are all, you know, different games that we played in. And that's Yost Fieldhouse. The clock used to, it was a circular clock, and the last minute of the game, the clock would turn color, so you'd know when it was the last minute because it had a second hand going around counting off the minutes on the clock. So it wasn't, you know, as easy to read the clock like it is today in a digital format. So.
What were the shot clocks then? I don't remember.
We didn't have one.
You didn't have one. Was that it?
No.
So what were the locker rooms like? I doubt that there were like saunas and whirlpools.
No, and everybody, you know, used that same locker room. There was a, you know, small training room, and the facilities they have now are just hard to conceive what they have there. I mean, went in the locker and the training room was as big as our locker room. But they have a hot tub, a cold tub. They have a floor where they actually can walk in and stand, and the floor goes up and down. It's big enough you could put a horse in it. I mean, it's just absolutely. And the gal that showed our group around when they had the dedication and they invited all the players back was on the women's staff. And so she said, well, of course the floor has to go up and down. She says, can you imagine if McClyman's was in there and then one of our 5'6" girls was in there? She says, she'd drowned. So the floor actually has holes in it, and they can raise it up and lower it down depending on how high you are, because they let them run in the water, which is great resistance for them, and it's not taxing on them. So when they have an injury, they do that. But after practice, a lot of times they'll go in and go in the cold tub first. I mean, it's like ice tub, and then maybe the hot, depending on what they need with the new techniques that they use from a training standpoint.
What did you have?
We had a tub that was about, you know, big enough for one person, you know, to get in. And they still have those, but, you know, now they have these whirlpools. Like if you go to a resort and you go in a hot tub, that's how big they are. I mean, they can get 6, 8, 10 people in them, in each of them. And then the whole team could go in the one that has the movable floor.
Besides the coaches, how many trainers and other people were with the team?
Well, in our day, we had the three coaches. We had one manager, John Phillips, his name was. And today they have, I think, a manager for every person that's on the team. I mean, John, we kid him, you know, that he did everything. You know, he'd get there, he'd take care of the pregame, he'd do all that stuff, you know, and help us with our bags or whatever. He did everything just by himself. Didn't have an assistant, nothing. And as I say now, and then whether it's good or bad, I mean, you go to the games, you see all these kids running around, and they got guys to mop the floor and do all those different things. So it's changed, you know, and they have four coaches, the coach, three assistants, and then they've got grad assistants, Lee, and, you know, they've got people at all these different things that they do now. So it's changed dramatically as far as the involvement. I mean, it's, you know, they're down there. I hate to see their hours with the football and the basketball staff. I mean, and I don't think it's any different with softball or baseball or anything else. They work round the clock, but they're compensated very well for what they do. And I think in a way they're overpaid and there's too much pressure, you know, involved in that. But why are people more generous to the university when the teams are successful when they're not? I mean, it's a big, big issue. I mean, we're not talking a few dollars difference. It's just human nature. So the success of the teams helps the general university in the contributions, not just to the athletic department, but to the university in general. It's much more. And to the community. And when the teams are successful, the people that sell shirts and I mean, it's just a big, big, huge business. And now they're talking about the National Hockey League game and how much money, $14 million of income is going to come in when that game is held here. And half the people will be from Canada that come to buy the tickets to go to those games. So, but TV is the big thing that really brought a lot of money into the system. And when Cannon was here, he says, well, tell him, you know, his philosophy with the change in the times of the games and everything. He says, tell them the game's at 1 o'clock. If they want to broadcast it, they can be here. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, with the money involved, he had to change, you know, what he was willing to do, too. But how do you like to go to a game 9 o'clock at night? You go to a basketball game? Starts at 9 o'clock? You know, you don't get home till midnight? I mean, but where's the money coming from? It's coming from the advertisers. You can go any time of the day, any night of the week, you can go on, and there's 2 or 3 basketball games going on at different places. So and I don't know, has it saturated? I mean, some people live for all those games. I like to watch the Michigan games. I'm not a pro fan, so, you know, I don't watch much pro. I much more enjoy watching the college game because there's much more personal things where you can see the development of the kids, where the pros are so good, you know, they're pushing and shoving. All of a sudden they blow the whistle and say, what happened? You know, did nothing different than happened the rest of the game. Maybe they beat each other up and you wonder why they call fouls. So,
do you remember dealing with the press back then?
Yeah, not really. Waned enough, you know, I knew because he followed us and then I coached. And, of course, it was a different relationship then. So you got to know him a little better because he would come to interview you or talk to you about articles and things after the games and everything. And then obviously watched his career, and he was just an outstanding guy. He was just wonderful to be with.
But the national guys hadn't really taken over to the point where you felt pressure from them, even though you were ranked number one and were...
You were kind of oblivious to that. We didn't, you know, have much. It's not like today when they go in there and, you know, they set up tables for the kids and everybody comes to talk to them. We didn't have much of that.
Oh, so you didn't have the whole table situation.
No, we didn't go through that round robin where everybody came and asked you questions and things.
So tell us about your color commentating for the radio station?
Well, I did both radio and TV. And it was a natural situation with my having been here, played and coached. And I worked with Tom Hemingway from WOM for quite a few years. And he was, again, just an unbelievably talented person. It was something he did for a long, long time. And then I wound up getting a chance to work for Pro-Am Sports, PASS. And we did Michigan, Michigan State, Western Michigan, and UD. I think the most games we did was maybe 20, 21, 22 in a year. And I worked with Larry Osterman, who, again, was just really an outstanding professional in his business. And when the Tigers got bought out, then right before the season started, they released him. And baseball was his big thing because of the number of baseball games they did. And they just said, you know, you're done. And a friend of the new owner or something took over broadcasting the games for him. So that was kind of a bad situation for him because it was his livelihood. And all of a sudden, you know, thankfully he was getting up there age-wise and everything. But enjoyed working with him as well. So, and I did work for the Big Ten for one season. We had two different broadcast crews, and so, you know, I worked with Lauren Brown most of the time, and you know, we might be doing wasn't always Michigan. It could be Illinois and Wisconsin. It could be any of the combinations that they had. And
so that involved a lot of travel.
Yeah, it did.
How many years did you do?
I only did the Big Ten for, I think, 2 years. Was the longest I did that. And then the Pro-Am Sports was good because I was back doing Michigan, which I enjoyed watching anyway. And the other games, I'd miss those games. But, I never pursued that. I mean, I never, you know, got a manager or anything like that. I had somebody that said I should have done that, and maybe I should have. But I miss it a little bit because it's nice, especially if you're just doing Michigan, to be able to go and, you know, and see the games and not have to pay to travel to do all that when the time comes. And it's hard, you know, to get away. The availability of tickets, they only get so many tickets, you know, for the away games. And the parents, obviously, if it's in an area where the parents live, they'll try to go to the games. We went to the, you know, Nebraska game, as I mentioned, and, you know, that's far enough away that there weren't a lot of parents there. There were a couple, but so it was easier for us to get tickets for that game than some, so... But it's fun. Winning is, you know, it's hard to replace that. The feeling of the kids and, you know, in the crowd. And now you look at Chrysler. I mean, I couldn't believe, you know, we went, you know, to the Ohio State game. I mean, I've never seen fans that were that avid here. I mean, when we were in – I was trying to remember when we were in Yost whether the people were – but the kids now, you know, they yell and scream and some things you don't want to hear. But, I mean, they really get involved in the game. And they were all the way up. I don't know if they gave T-shirts to everybody that was in a second tier of the thing, but it was all yellow, and I think a lot of them were students, so they have their Maize Rage shirts. But I've never seen, I mean, it was exciting. Everybody was worked up and standing up during the game and everything. So,
do the players react to that?
Oh, I think they have to. Yeah, and they've played to that. When they come out before they go into the, you know, to get ready for the game, they run down, you know, in front of the Maize Rage and they high five all the kids on the way in. So they're, you know, they're working that as much as they can. And it obviously, you know, is an adrenaline type of thing when the home crowd. And look how difficult it is to win on the road. Michigan was, you know, they say, well, they're never going to win on an away game. All of a sudden now they, you know, they're just as good on the road, you know, the last few games. To go to Illinois and win there for the first time in a dozen or more years was quite an accomplishment. And there's certain places that, you know, the crowd has, you know, a big input on what you're – in what you're doing. And so it was nice to see him make that transition. And you can, to me, tell the way the team has developed and the fact that you watch the game sometimes and I find a lot of things that could be a lot better, you know, and the mistakes they make and the things they do, and yet they're still winning. And so now I think they've gone to a second transition is before, you know, I read a book about that guy. He says, well, you know, you win ugly, he says, and then, you know, you win a little easier, and then you wind up games where you don't play so well that you win. And I think we've made that transition here with John Beilein's team because of his coaching skills, that all of a sudden now that, you know, you say, geez, they did so many things wrong, but yet they're winning. And winning on the road in the Big Ten is been a struggle. Look at Northwestern. They're probably not going to make the tournament. We had to go overtime twice with them to beat them. And I'm not really looking forward. I, in a way, hope Minnesota wins instead of Northwestern when they play in this consolation game on Thursday, because, you know, it's hard to beat a team three times in a row.
That was a real nail biter.
Yeah, yeah. So, and they're just, you know, they're so close to being there. And they've never gone to the NCAA tournament. Never in the history of Northwestern University have they played basketball in the national tournament. And they're probably not going to make it this year unless they make a run in the Big Ten tournament and win. Then they would get selected automatically as a Big Ten, you know, as the tournament champion. But they've never played. Never. All the teams they've had, they've never played. No, I didn't either. And they've been announcing it quite a bit lately.
Because they always seem strong.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the Carmody plays the backdoor, what they call a Princeton offense, where they, you know, they're constant moving. And
there's one more thing I want to ask. From some of the articles, that was a big deal whether you wear white or you wear your dark jersey in these games. Is that a psychological thing for the player, that if you wear white?
Not that I'm aware of, but usually it's the home team wears the white. I mean, and
but
so it depends
if
on who's designated. Yeah, but again, they're going to designate one team as the home team.
So how
in
do
all
they
these
pick?
Games. Well, I don't know. They probably have it on the chart, so I don't know. And like when you look at a score, it'll be Ohio State at Michigan. Well, the team on the right is the home team all the time. When you look at the ESPN, they'll come on, so-and-so's playing at so-and-so. Well, it's always the team on the right is the home team. They're playing at that location normally. And so I don't know whether they would keep that same format, but, yeah, they'll designate the whole time as to who's
so the team doesn't care if they wear no?
I don't know that anybody be that superstitious. I should have brought my uniforms in when they had it. Of course, the baggy short phenomena started with the Fab Five here at Michigan. We actually, the shirts were like a, what do they call it when kids have a little diaper thing where the shirts had tails on them and they came up in front and you had to button them.
Oh.
And the shorts, you can see, I mean, they were barely, you know, if they were 10 inches long, it was long. And now, of course, everybody's got the shorts are hanging down below their knees. You can't, you know, they pull them down and their shirts are coming out all the time. And we didn't have that option. A lot of guys didn't like the fact that it tucked up underneath, so they would, you know, arrange it in their supporter so that they didn't have to have it buttoned underneath. But we never had to worry about our shirts coming out either, because it's against the rules, supposedly, to have your shirt hanging out. So
you think the Fab Five did away with that rule, or they got a...
They started the baggy short thing. That started, and it should be Brian Dutcher was the assistant at that time, and they tried to blame him, or I don't know if he was responsible and found him out or whatever, but it was that mentality of that group that you know, that's the way... And then once they wore those, I mean, it became a phenomenon everywhere. You don't see anybody with short shorts anymore. I mean, everybody said, well, don't you feel funny being out there in your underwear? I said, you know, I never give thought to it. Once the game starts, everything goes out of your mind. You don't think about the crowd. You don't think about any of those things. I mean, you're concentrating on, you know, what you're trying to do. But the basketball now, I mean, went in that new facility, and it's been a dire need, I mean, as far as facilities. And redoing the arena was good because they held all those concerts in there. I mean, you'd sit in your seat and there were springs coming out of the seat. I mean, you could literally feel the springs in the seats. And so that part is nice. And, of course, they're tearing it apart again to widen all the mezzanine is going to be twice as wide. And they'll, you know, have interactive video stuff up there to see the old teams and all that stuff. Our team will probably be, you know, on there in some way. But in the locker rooms, I mean, they have everything mirrored on both sides. The women and the men, everything's the same. And I kidded Dick Honig and I, who coached together again, I mentioned him. We went in, and when we first went into the basketball wing on the right-hand side was an office, and I looked at Dick, and it was the manager's office. I said, Dick, I said, this office is bigger than you and I shared when we were on the staff 50, 40 years ago. So it is interesting what they do. And technology-wise, each of the players has an iPad that is built into their locker. It slides into a thing, and they have their own picture on there as
the wallpaper.
They have their own picture with their screen on there. Well, John has always been very big on filming, and so he'll spend hours with the kids going over games and what other people do. Well, now instead of each of the players having to go in and watch the whole game, the audiovisual person goes in there, and if we're playing Ohio State and I'm going to be guarding Sullinger, then Morgan's iPad will have all the things that Sullinger does. So he doesn't have to watch what everybody else is doing. All he concentrates on what Sullinger does on offense and defense. And they each have these in their lockers, so they can go in there anytime they want. Instead of having to go in the audiovisual room and sit down with somebody and do that, they can take it home with them, look at it, do all that. And John has always been big on showing people on film exactly what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong to re-support them. And he goes to the extent, and he said this early on, which you didn't really realize, is that we just don't do it on a negative basis. So let's say Hardaway's having a hard time all of a sudden shooting, which he's gone through a period where he couldn't hit the basket. So go in there and they'll take all the shots that he made and say, well, look at here, you know, you're doing there to reinforce his mental capacity of saying I should still be shooting and things. So it's not just negative that they show him, but it's the positive things as well. So they it was amazing what they've done, and it, you know, it's what goes on a lot of other places as well, and most of the schools are updating all that stuff. So interesting.
To learn more about George Palmy and the 1964 and 65 Michigan Wolverine basketball teams, visit oldnews.aadl.org.
AADL Talks to George Palmy has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.